let's sit down. How'd that work?
That's good.
Yeah. Oh, that worked. I'll give you 30 seconds to grab a seat, and then we'll get rolling here. Hey, Kristen. Well, good morning, everyone. My name is Dick Peterson. I am director of Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality and a proud member of the task force for the Pacific States British Columbia Oil Spill Task Force. And I'm Oregon's member, and it's a pleasure that I'm here today and that you're here all today. I really appreciate not only this event, but the work that you all do. And certainly for those of you that aren't from Portland or from Oregon, welcome to our beautiful state, our beautiful city, and I hope you're enjoying it. You know, one thing that people have to do if they're new here is go buy some Voodoo Donuts, and that's all I need to say. You can ask anybody where it's at, and you'll go get some. So those pink boxes that you see people carry around, that's Voodoo Donuts. I also have to say, I didn't realize it, but when I walked into this room, 11 years ago, I was probably did things really embarrassing in this specific room, and this is the room that we had the reception for my daughter's wedding 11 years ago, and I'm sure I was sang and did some toast and danced and all that kind of stuff. Well, you're not going to see that from me today. I'll tell you one interesting thing though. This, if you've been involved in weddings, these kind of things happen. But going to the men's room, and there were rose petals in the urinals. So that was kind of funny, I thought. But,
Thanks for that.
I checked it out today, and they're not there. I thought that was going to be your gift, Gary, from Hawaii. Yeah. Well, I want to say that this is the 25th anniversary of the task force, and it's pretty exciting to me that we have been engaged that long and doing great things, and continue to do great things, and in working to prepare for and respond to oil spills, which we all know is preparing for is really, really important, and be in a position to respond to an unfortunate event if it does happen is ultimately really important to protect our environment, our public health, and the things that are important to us all that live here in the coastal states in Hawaii. And again, I really appreciate the work that you do to prepare for and respond to oil spills. It's not an easy business, and the commitment that you all have and my counterparts have is amazing to me. And we're all there for everyone that cares about the environment that we live in. Many of the things that the task force does are highlighted in the annual report that is out on the desk and there. And I hope not only you take a copy, but you spend some time looking through it to get a little taste of the good work that is happening with this task force and the work that we do. And you're going to hear more about the work that the task force does from Sarah And speaking of Sarah, Sarah Brace is our executive coordinator for the task force, and Hillary Wilkinson is our executive support for the task force. If you two want to just raise your hand. Please. And it's, you know, the thing that makes a task force work is the people that make it work. And Sarah and Hillary are not only a big part of that, but they're kind of the oil of the machinery. And so I know the task force, my task force, our task force members, or your task force members, not only appreciate that, but really agree with them that you're what makes it happen. So again, thank you. We do have a great agenda today, certainly it's on a very important and timely topic on oil train movement and oil movement that's ever increasing. So it's important, and really appreciate everyone that's here to not only hear about that topic, but here to present an aspect of it so that we're all not only aware, but we're informed about what's going on there. And one thing that I wanted to point out as far as logistics go is lunch is identified on your in your agenda, and it's a hosted lunch, and it's where, Sarah?
It's going to be right outside in the lobby area. Mm-hmm. There'll be a buffet set up, and so you can exit that door in the rear back, grab your food, and come back in again with your food and enjoy it here.
And the other thing I want to mention is that there's bios in your packet, and I don't think you're going to hear that the people that introduce speakers spend a lot of time reading bios, because they're there for you. So we want to just make sure we reserve time for the speakers to present to you, and don't take a lot of time reading bios, because as you'll see in the packet, they're very extensive. We got a great panel of speakers. So with that, I am going to introduce our first panel, which is your task force members from each of the states in British Columbia. So I'm going to start, and if you could just raise your hand, I'll just say Dale Jensen is the Spills Program Manager for Washington Department of Ecology. Thomas Cullen is Administrator for California's Department of Fish and Wildlife. And Wes Shoemaker is Deputy Minister for British Columbia Ministry of Environment. Gary Gill is Deputy Director for the Hawaii Department of Health. And Kristen Ryan is Director, Spill Prevention and Response Division, Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. So I'm going to turn the mic over to Dale Jensen, good friend, task force member, and fellow native Montanan. So thanks, there you go.
Let me grab your Good morning, everyone. Great to see you here this morning. It's a great turnout, and I think, as Dick said, a lot of really good things going on today. This is this task force work is really cool stuff, and it's been really important to all of us as jurisdictions for many years now, since the early 90s when this first began, but I'm sure Sarah will talk more about that later. There's so much going on, and you know, this part of the conversation today is really around the jurisdictional, you know, updates. So it's a little bit broader than just talking about crude by rail today, but it's really to give you kind of a highlight of some of the things that have been going on at a broader level in our program. And then I do have, I am part of another panel where I'll probably get more into the specifics of some of the things that we've been working on around rail. In our state, we have about, you know, just under 4,000 vessel entries. My vessel inspectors target about 10% of the high-risk vessels in the state. We have some criteria that we apply. And it really helped, it's really focused on prevention aspects. We also have about nearly 4,000 reported spills every single year, and based on a criteria that we apply to those, we're actually, you know, on scene physically with about just under 900 of those. Most of the spills that we report or respond to are oil-related. Our environmental report tracking system does have this category other, and so everybody always asks, what's the other stuff? Well, that particular system comes into our agency, and we broker out information to the other programs. So that could be sewage discharge, you know, spills. It could be, you know, other spills that affect, you know, other programs. But for us, our focus is really on the oil and hazardous material spills, but we spend most of our time on oil. Just one other note on that. It's unfortunately in our state, it's small spills. We've been very fortunate, I don't know if this is wood, but very fortunate to not have a big spill in our state in a long time. And it really has to do with a lot of really hard work that's been going on with our Federal Coast Guard partners, EPA, local partners, industry partners. It takes a lot of work to make sure that we have low impact spills in our state. We have had a couple of pretty significant incidents. We did have a landslide in Oso, and it did impact wiped out a small community. There were about 43 people that were killed in that. We had a response that went on for about 5 weeks. It was very intense, lots of involvement in that, very sad situation. It impacted the Stillaguamish River. Cut off that river flow, so of course the lower the communities downriver were evacuated for fear that this natural dam that was forming when that river was cut off would maybe release and impact the communities down below. That didn't happen. The river kind of found its way through, but it was just a major cleanup effort. This is still going on. We had about 100 folks from ecology that were involved in that. And then massive, you know, folks from other organizations. A lot of hazardous material cleanup in that. The other thing that we really end up spending quite a bit of time on, and our Coast Guard partners will attest to this, is the derelict vessels. So we spend a lot of time on derelict vessel issues. This one in particular was the Helena Star and the Golden West, two vessels in the Commencement Bay Tacoma area that just were really in tough shape. One of them sunk, ended up falling on the other, so it was a situation where we had to remove both of those particular vessels. But I think, you know, the work that goes on we've been successful with is really bringing together our Coast Guard, our Department of Natural Resources, and Ecology, and really trying to figure out how we can get a handle on this problem. We each have different authorities, so it really is, you know, trying to figure out how far we can take the state's authorities in helping with this situation, and also working with our Coast Guard federal partners and where their authorities are to remove those. So it continues to go on. We've had some successful legislation in the state of Washington where now old and large vessels have to have insurance, private marinas have to have make sure that the vessels in their marina have insurance and proof of insurance. There's a tax exemption for deconstruction. There's a revenue fee that's applied to large vessels. It's about a $1 per foot fee that's collected. It goes into the Department of Natural Resource Vessel Recovery Fund, and then that particular money is used to help us in the removal process for derelict vessels. And then there's moorings providers have to provide, you know, information. So if there's a release, then we can get access to, you know, other vessels around that information, that particular spill, and find out more about narrowing down who the source is. The other thing is we have a very active attorney general in our state. He's fairly new, I think a couple of years into his tenure, but one of the things that he's really taken on is applying criminal charges to derelict vessel situations, and it's been really pretty successful. He has about four cases going on right now. we just recently settled one. These are people that really don't have money. They really don't have the resources. It costs them a buck to follow their dream, and it really costs them a lot of money in the end. And in some of these situations, there's not only natural resource damage assessments that are applied, there's civil penalties that are applied, and now criminal penalties that are applied. So in this one case, we had this person, the settlement outcome was he spent about 20 days in jail, and I think it'll take him 200 years to pay back his costs. But the point is there's a really good message there that we're really working to, you know, get out to the public and have them think about the investments that they're getting into before they go there. And then, you know, with all that, there is the rail. There's the emerging, you know, issues, which is really a huge dynamic change for, you know, our state. Just been taking a lot of time and energy by us and many others here on the West Coast. We've seen a real shift in the way that crude oil comes into our state in the last 10 years. Primarily vessels has been 90% of the way that crude oil comes into our state. Pipeline was a small portion of that. Now, in the last 10 years, much more of an increase in crude oil brought in by pipeline. We have one pipeline that comes in out of Canada that's been, you know, up to capacity, near capacity on moving crude oil in. And then now we're seeing, you know, rail. You know, so we're seeing a fairly significant increase in how rail is coming in. So it's not so much that change, but it's really, you know, the volume that's coming in into our state and the type of oil that's really a concern to us. So this is real different for us. This is a map of the state of Washington, and so it's real different for us. It's a big shift. We've worked really hard with a lot of partners over the years to really put in good prevention, preparedness, response practices on the marine side. Now it's just so different. We don't have that same level of capability on the east side, on the inland waters and streams. So a lot of work, you know, going on with that. Right now we've got the Bakken oil in particular that comes in from North Dakota and Montana fields, comes through Idaho, through Spokane, mainly down along the Columbia River, and then some deliveries along the Columbia River, and then on up into the refineries up in the northwestern part of our state. So it's a real different time, and I think the other thing that's real different about it is we've never had crude oil moving from the east side of our state to the west side. So just how our response capabilities is, how we understand the product, how we understand the characteristics, how we train and we're ready is all part of the work that's underway right now. We also have, in early summer, there was a DOT order that required the railroads to report rail that were coming into the state. Right now, and this is by county, this particular chart that we have, but there was a lot of conversation around confidential, you know, business information, if that was, you know, reportable information. It was determined that it was, that it couldn't be kept in confidence. Our state has a very open public disclosure laws, so pretty much anything that comes to us is available to the public. So we worked with the State Emergency Response Committee through the Emergency Management Department and put in place a web link. So the information is reported on a weekly basis. The public can see that information. Everybody can see that information, and our first responders are beginning to, you know, see that information and think about how they can prepare for that. So that's, you know, ongoing, but I think as our communities have more and more information, they feel safer. So it really is about, you know, being well informed and understand really what's coming through their communities. This was another, actually, part of that DOT call, I guess, in July, mid-July range. There was also a call for safer cars. So we've all been working on providing input to the federal rulemaking that, you know, looks at safer cars and it looks at contingency planning, the types of work that we've been doing for a long time on the marine side and now working to apply it on the inland side. about a day after. I think that was July 23rd, and I think July 24th was the next day just after that announcement. We had a small derailment under the Magnolia Bridge in Seattle, and I think the thing that's really kind of interesting is the public is so aware. It's such a changing dynamic that we're all experiencing where we respond to spills in a certain way on the marine side, but we have room to grow in how we respond to spills on the inland side and around rail incidents. If the public knows what kind of train, if it's a unit train of oil, it just significantly increases the attention around that. So the more that we can do to work with our rail partners and others to get the information out soon and help manage the information flow and ensure that the public is safe when we respond to these spills is really important. So there's a lot of public confidence that is really has a lot of room to grow, and we all have a lot of work to get there. last session, we've been working, as I said earlier, Tesoro was one of the first companies that came in to our state with oil, so that was the fall of 2012. We'd been working on prior to that, even through our area committee work, as coal trains were coming in and or being proposed to come in, and then oil was coming in. We started doing a lot of work through our area committee and within our respective states to look at what we could do to begin to get ahead of this. And so in our state, we did propose last legislative session some investment in some expertise and really information gathering and putting in place some good geographic response planning. We talked about a 5-year cycle on our plans that we needed to work on. And, there were so many good ideas last legislative session. It didn't come out exactly the way that I had hoped it would, though. So we did get 1 year of funding for 3 positions where we began to develop some geographic response plans on inland waters. So we've been doing a lot of work. There's a lot of public workshops going on to develop those. So pay attention to those. We want everybody's input as we develop those plans. We've got a 1-year big push, and then we recognize that we really needed to develop good risk skills within our program. So we did hire somebody that's getting up to snuff on the rail issues, and we also have somebody working on the vessel risk side as well. So we're pretty excited about how we're focusing on the risk side and looking at mitigation opportunities and planning aspects as well. We did get out of the session, even though not as much as I wanted came out of it. We did get a directive to do a study, and many in this room have been involved in that study process. I was very fortunate to soon after the study came out, hire Scott Ferguson, who many of you know. He was the sector commander for Puget Sound at the time, and he's been my study lead on this and has just done an awesome job in helping us. So not only did we get this proviso out of the legislature that basically said, have a report done by March 1st of 2015, about 2 months later, then our governor said, I want it sooner. I want more work. I want a preliminary report by October 1st. So we delivered that day before yesterday, and the governor is making an announcement today in Seattle on that. So the time frame for us right now is, our funding for this came into play in July 1st. There's been a big, heavy push. We've delivered our preliminary draft that's going to inform some legislation this session. A lot of outreach. We've got public sessions at the end of this month in Seattle and in Spokane. Have had a lot of workshops, a lot of stakeholder work. That'll continue. Have to deliver a draft report. The one that you will see today that will be posted is about 100 pages. The preliminary draft, I think, is about 800 pages with a lot of technical information in it. And then a lot more work that will continue on through the legislative session, and then March first is our final report delivery, but it really is a multi-year process. It's not going to stop this year. It didn't stop 2 years ago, and it'll continue on. So a lot of really, really good work by all of our stakeholders. So that's kind of where we are in our process, and I'll talk a little bit more about the details in the next session.
Everyone, it's wonderful to be here with you this morning. Okay, show of hands, who's here joining me from California? Isn't it great to see some precipitation for a change? My goodness. Well, it's been a good year for us in the state of California, and I'll follow Dale's lead and knock on this particle board here. I'll start out with going the wrong direction. Talking a little bit about some of the highlights from the past year with respect to the spills. I could provide a bunch of stats about all the drills and vessel inspections and so forth, but let's focus on the spills. And then we'll talk a little bit about the success that we had in the previous legislative cycle addressing the inland threat, not just rail, but pipeline. In any place that oil is moved or contained, it wants to escape. And it was a gap for us, and we're very, very pleased that we got the governor's attention. And through a lot of hard work, I think we're poised to address the coming threat. So on the marine side, which is where we spend most of our effort to date, we're down a bit with volume and reports of spills. The data for 2014 is current as of this previous Friday. We had to extrapolate out, of course, you know, for the remaining 3 months of the year, but there is a downward trend. The difference in colors of the barcodes basically show the type of response, whether we actually put folks physically out there or there was just a telephone consultation. And since we have a very robust protective strategy, you know, partnership with our marine partners, they're very good at containing, cleaning up, and as Dale said, there's a lot of really small spills that do not require us to physically go out there. On the inland side, also a slight downward trend, which is, of course, good. I wanted to bring to your attention four kind of representative spills of the very diverse aspects of how oil can go out. I'll start from north to south. In January of this year, we had a small train derailment up in the Shasta Shasta County, Sacramento River. There were about 17 cars that derailed, two of which went into the water. It was not an oil train. I believe that there were some dry goods on their way to retail. And it was a very small release of oil, you know, fuel oil for the engine, you know, some other hydraulic and so forth that went in. This introduced, of course, the concern of the remoteness of where a lot of these rail lines are and the difficulty it's going to be, you know, getting response resources there. And then also the swift water aspect. You know, that's when water was flowing a lot quicker than it is now, unfortunately, in California. And it might spill here, but it's going to be miles and miles away, perhaps, by the time you arrive. And there's a whole different, you know, set of species and so forth that could be affected. The next spill moving south was a tanker truck, a tandem truck that rolled over on Highway 1 up in Jenner, and it released about 5,500 gallons of petroleum-based road sealer. And it was very thick, slow to move, easy to contain, of course. And again, it was an accessibility with now also very, very poor communications. This is an area that was very sensitive. It affected marine waters, you know, going into where there's, you know, abalone and right in the middle of the season. I got to keep doing that. I'm sorry. I got to keep my hands. is here. The next one was a true marine concern, a potential of a barge that that foundered and eventually sank, and it was in a marine protected area, and it sank right next to a submerged pipeline, you know, coming in from an offshore rig, and you know, we wanted to get it further offshore, out of the marine protected area, but and concern about it, it dragging across the pipeline. Thank goodness nothing was released. Again, there was a little bit, but there was the numbers on there aren't what was spilled. It was what was on board, about 500 gallons of some petroleum, some magnesium chloride, but we were able to get it further out to shore, where it would not be as much of a threat. The final one was, you know, was one of our biggest concerns in the state was with pipelines, and this was a pipeline breach in Los Angeles in a very heavy residential area, and this underscored the importance of having very strong, well-trained and equipped partners, especially at the local level, because the LA Fire Department did an absolutely remarkable job in getting on scene, deploying containment right away, and keeping between 500 1,000 and a million gallons of crude from going into the storm drains and then straight into the Pacific Ocean. You can see at the bottom, the business that was most affected was a gentleman's club, completely saturated in oil. I won't invite comment on that. Wrong direction. So let's talk a little bit about how we looked at what the future trends were going to be that were going to affect California. Basically, California receives its oil from four different sources, Alaska, overseas, offshore platforms, and then inland production. And it arrives by ship or by pipeline up to, you know, 2012. We applied a 6.5 cent per barrel fee on those three things circled. We don't have a fee on anything coming into the state, either out of the ground from inland production or by rail. About 70% is what we applied that 6.5 cent per barrel fee on. Looking ahead to the future, we realized there was going to be a dramatic shift, perhaps as much as a 30% shift from marine to rail. California has about 20 refineries, 14 of which process crude oil. It's a fairly fixed capacity. Chevron's increasing their capacity in Point Reyes a little bit, but not significantly. And we realized that, A, there's a greater threat of oil moving in the state that we're not poised to respond to, and was going to be a dramatic drop in our revenue stream to protect the state. You know, this is a graph that we've all, you know, seen about the dramatic increase of what is going to be coming into the West Coast from the Bakken Formation. And this is my Rock of Gibraltar slide showing the what they expect the daily production coming out of Bakken is going to be, you know, nationwide. And sure enough, you know, it's tracking fairly close to what the prediction is. We're up to, I believe it's around 1,100 million barrels, and 1.1 million barrels a day that's being produced. It's a remarkable number. This is kind of a busy slide. We did some analysis. We looked at, you know, permit applications that industry is putting out, you know, environmental impact reports on what they predict for rail transfers in the state. And when we did the math, it looked like it was going to be between about 150 and 200 million barrels a year. That'd be about 6.5 trains per day. There's also going to be some that's going to be coming in by barge to California. And so we realized that there was going to be a need to really poise ourselves better to respond to the shift in the trend. So we built a bunch of slides and presented them to the governor's staff. And we found just, this is a slide that I just got 3 days ago from one of my resource economists that show that our numbers are actually probably a little bit off as we look at what industry's predicting. The circles show that they're colored basically by what's current, what's in the short term, and that, you know, in the perhaps distant future of what industry expects are going to be the movement, the transfers of oil in millions of barrels per year. And now the number is not only, you know, 180 perhaps million barrels, but 230 million barrels, or about 10 trains a day. And we have the luxury in California that we're only now starting to see the trains rolling, unlike you know, Washington, New York State, other states out there. They're kind of behind the eight ball, so to speak. You know, we're very, very fortunate that we're able to kind of predict and poise ourselves for the threat. We looked at where some of the routes are with respect to where refineries, where the oil is ultimately going to go. And you can see that there's about 5 refineries in the Bay Area. Most are down in the L.A. Basin. And these are some of the main rail lines that go. When you superimpose it on waterways in the state, there's about 7,000 rail crossings. Now, that doesn't take into account all of those miles and miles of where rail travels parallel to water, but it's certainly a significant threat. And, of course, rail provides a right-of-way and an easement for pipeline. There's a lot of submerged pipeline that handles product and crude that travels along, and there's about 5,000 crossings of pipeline carrying petroleum over water. I want to talk a little bit about the unit train that that Dale mentioned earlier. I think everybody in here is familiar with it. This was one of the more effective things that we used to persuade the legislature to understand the threat. A unit train, between 75, we're saying 100, could be as many as 120 of the, right now, primarily the DOT 111 tank cars that can handle about 30,000 gallons of crude. If you look at what indices reasonable worst case scenario for a spill, they're saying that one tank car. But if you look at the historical perspective, 2013, it's 20 cars, and further you go back, it's about 20 cars that will derail and perhaps release product. When you kind of put that in perspective, what it means for us in California, we had a big spill in 2007 called the Coscusan, and it released the equivalent of 1.5 tank cars. So you multiply that out, and potentially 20, and it's a very significant event. This was our challenge. We received the fee on the marine side. We're limited to spills at the time on the marine side. We're resourced, and we were restricted also for any spills greater than a barrel of petroleum. We did not have the resources to go inland. For 2012, you can see that there's a difference between the number of spills per year, the volumes, but there's no resourcing for it. And we said, well, we have to protect the state's resources statewide, and that's what we developed as a statewide program. If you look at the reports for a two-year period that went into the California Office of Emergency Services, spills happen everywhere. You can almost pick out Interstate 5, the little line, going from north down to Sacramento. It happens anywhere oil moves. Busy slide that describes, the trailer bill, Senate Bill 861, that accompanied the governor's line item that basically asked to extend our 6.5 cent per barrel fee to any oil that comes into the state and arrives at a refinery. It has a single statewide program. It gives us the ability to cascade those proven effective aspects of the protective strategy on the marine side now statewide with contingency planning and certificates of financial responsibility, drills and exercises. It would stabilize the funding for our oil wildlife care network, which was because of the way it was structured to be funded, was starting to run out of money quickly, and it's a center of excellence, 30-plus wildlife centers that industry can just name in their contingency plan as a one-stop shop for going out and taking care of those various types of wildlife that could be affected by a spill. And very importantly, it gave us access to our state version of the National Response Fund. We have a $55 million oil spill response fund that previously was only used for spills in the marine zone greater than a barrel. Now we can use it statewide. We removed the barrel restriction, so any visible sheen, we can now go and front end a response as we, then look at, cost recovery. Left side, again, those vectors showing that, where the oil is moving, all choke pointed at a refinery, and that's where we would collect that fee. It makes the most sense. We have about 20 teams, internal teams, that are working on various aspects of rolling out statewide. We're working very hard on getting emergency regulations out. We've met with industry, had scoping sessions, trying to identify who the new plan holders will be. One of the big challenges is going to be developing those geographic response plans. You can see that on the marine side, our area plans, our area contingency plans, cover the whole marine zone. Very little done except for some small corridors of some more treacherous rail areas that have the geographic response plan. So we're going to need to identify those sensitive sites, those response strategies to contain oil. all the benefits, which are obvious, of a program that now is statewide. And we'll be talking a little bit more in the next panel about some of the challenges, the growing pains, the interagency coordination, and so forth. So I thank you all for your attention, and looking forward to another great year ahead in protecting our resources. Thank you.
There she is.
Dealing with a little technical glitch.
I up next. Kakayaka, Kako. How's everybody this morning? Something you're supposed to say. Mike Cutty. That's what you're supposed to say. I'm Gary Gale from Hawaii. Sorry I couldn't find a tie to match the shirt, but we're going to talk about a little bit different things this morning for you, and see if I can start my own clock there so that Hillary doesn't have to yank me off stage. Well, Hawaii is like nowhere else, so I'm going to be talking to you about some problems that we have that probably nobody else does. If you recall, last year I talked a little bit about a molasses spill, right? What's black and sticky and kills fish, but is really good in oatmeal cookies. So I can give you a little update about that. But what we've had that nobody else possibly could have is a spill from this Red Hill facility underground storage tanks. Pearl Harbor. And I'm just going to run through this because I think it might be instructive, and I'm sure it's interesting, and it takes up most of my time among everything else I have to do. Pearl Harbor is the reason I'm here today. Pearl Harbor is the reason that people in Hawaii speak English instead of Hawaiian, as the United States of America spread across the continent and ran across something called the Pacific Ocean and kept wanting to go west. Well, Pearl Harbor is what got them there. This is a huge, natural, and deep draft harbor in the middle of the Pacific. Initially leased from the nation of Hawaii to the United States for a coaling station to recoal the U.S. fleet, soon became the reason, ultimately, militarily and politically, why the United States governs Hawaii today. The groundwater from the island seeps through the bedrock and the basalt into the ancient coral shelf of the south of the island. It eroded out the limestone into Pearl Harbor, a natural embayment and a natural place for the Pacific Fleet. But years ago, all the demands for fuel in Pearl Harbor were met by above-ground storage tanks, which were not secure from a military standpoint. And back in just before World War II, as the buildup to the Pacific War was taking place, some very brilliant engineers decided that they could take all that fuel and move it underground. And so what is Red Hill is actually a ridge line of the Ko'olau Mountains above Pearl Harbor, just a few miles away. And what they did is something that has never been done before or since. Two rows of 10 underground storage tanks built into the bedrock, into the basaltic volcanic rock. Each tank holding 12.5 million gallons times 20. So the fuel is piped and pumped up into the ridgeline, and then it flows down to fuel vessels at Pearl Harbor by gravity. You can see that although when it was built it was like on the edge of a sugar field, now it's surrounded by housing, quarry, industrial area, the freeway runs just below it. It's pretty much smack in the middle of urban Honolulu. These are 250 feet high and 100 feet across. If you're familiar with the Aloha Tower, you can easily fit the Aloha Tower smack into each one of these. They were built top secret in 3 years. Something Well, I guess it would take you 3 years just to do the environmental impact statement today. But it was built totally under secret cover and has been in active operation since 1943. So the Navy responded as they needed to. They told us that there was a spill. They didn't know how much it was back in January. The original estimate was 12,000 gallons. We notified the Board of Water Supply, who did an emergency response. This is the underground tunnel at the bottom of each of these tanks. That's the tank 5, the one that spilled off on the left. So there is lots of evidence that the spill actually did take place. We monitored the petroleum vapor under the tank. Eventually, the Navy recalculated the spill, and the current running total is 27,000 gallons of jet fuel, JP8. This is a stain underneath the tank, petroleum and groundwater squeezing out into the tunnel below the tank. We immediately did a unified command, engaged with the Department of Health. On our side is our emergency response office, our solid and hazardous waste branch that regulates underground storage tanks, and our safe drinking water branch, because the groundwater immediately below these tanks is a source of drinking water for both the Navy and the state of Hawaii, or the county of Honolulu. So basically, immediately in response to this latest spill, we did a surety sampling of all the groundwater, drinking water shafts, and could identify that there has, to date, not been a significant contamination of our drinking water. But frankly, these spills have been going on for 70 years. We've been working on this project for some time. We don't know where that plume is. We do know that there's contamination of the groundwater. You see the lines of black dots there. Those are the tanks. At the top of the slide, you see Halava Shaft. That's Halava Shaft. And down at the bottom, that big blue dot is the Moana Lua Shaft. Those two Board of Water Supply shafts supply about 25% of the drinking water for urban Honolulu. And right between them is the Red Hill facility. If you look just to the lower left of those Red Hill dots, you'll see the Halava Red Hill shaft. That's part of the Navy's Pearl Harbor drinking water supply. The red dots are monitoring wells that we've been working for the past 10 years with the Navy to do, and we've identified contamination directly under these tanks. We don't know where the contamination is going. So this is my pop science plume that I arbitrarily just put on there for demonstration purposes. We don't know where the plume is other than directly below the tanks. But if it were to travel directly downslope, it would run smack into the Navy's drinking water supply. And in fact, we have a hit of naphthalene in the Navy's drinking water. However, the geologists say that there's probably a northward slope based on their analysis of groundwater movement, which would take it heading directly towards the Halava Shaft. If it happens to be going south or part of it south, it runs right into Moana Lua Stream and a direct trajectory to the Board of Water Supply well at Moana Lua. So we're now currently trying to figure out where it's going. This is a cutaway to show basically each of those tanks. On the right side of the slide, the tunnel beneath them, and 80 feet to the groundwater. And the Navy's drinking water system there on the bottom left is an infiltration tunnel right at the groundwater level, and that supplies the drinking water for the Navy. Another concern is that should one of these pipelines or tanks actually rupture, it'll run right down that tunnel and right into the well. This is a graphic of the 20 tanks. This is data that was provided to us up until 1984 from the Navy. You see the two red tanks, 1 and 19, have been closed because they were leaking beyond repair. All of the kind of brownish ones have reported leaks. The yellow ones have not reported leaks up until 1984. But you see the little oil spill under each one of them? In our work with the Navy historically, we have done some drilling of the basalt, and under each one of these tanks there's petroleum staining, except number 10, which has reported leaks. So where we dug the core samples under tank 10, we missed the stain. But it's fair to say that each one of these tanks historically for the past 70 years has continually leaked to some extent into the basaltic layer beneath. And we know that there's contamination, as I said, 80 feet below, directly into the groundwater. There's the stained core, coring samples, as an example of what we've identified under each of these tanks. It's just a cutaway to show you how close those tanks really are to our groundwater supply. And as is probably true in other states, the groundwater is owned by the public and held in trust by those of us who work for government. It is not owned by the Navy or anyone other than the public of Hawaii, and it is our duty to protect it for future generations. So you're probably familiar with the underground storage tank requirements generally. You've got to have leak detection, secondary containment. We have cleaned up almost 2,000 spills already in the Department of Health. And typically, you know, this is the kind of operation for a 10,000-gallon tank. There's 10,000 of these in each one of the underground tanks at Red Hill. Because they're field constructed, not all the typical underground storage tank rules apply. They don't legally need to have leak detection or secondary containment, but our state law still gives us those authority over the yellow points, 4 out of 10 points in the law. I'm going to skip through a bunch of this stuff. Basically, just to talk about what we have tried to do in terms of cleaning up and responding. The Navy did drain immediately tank number 5. Took them a couple months to get in and try and assess what damage has been done. Here's the Navy slide of their activity in terms of response. This is back from July, so some of those things have actually happened already. They're already drilling 2 Sentinel wells, 2 new wells. They're pretty much on their schedule to do that. This is just a fraction of the things we think they need to do. Here's the deal on tank 5. There's 17 holes in it. And those are the holes that they found after investigating fewer than 50 anomalies. There are 600 anomalies in this tank. And this is a tank that was just refurbished and put back into operation just prior to its leaking. So what does that tell you about the other tanks? This is in the upper right there, maybe a little blurry to see. That's in the middle of tank 5 looking up towards the dome. And each of those little white dots is an anomaly that's been identified by the Navy. The lower right there, looking down at that white disc, that's the bottom of tank 5 where, as part of its refurbishing, they painted the bottom. But the rest used to be painted green and has just been, you know, sandblasted off. So we're trying to go after the fuel. They have not recovered any fuel yet. They haven't been able to get any raw of the product out of the soil. That's a vacuum box that the Navy's used to actually test the anomalies. They stick a little box over it, make it airtight, pump the air out, and see if it leaks from the outside. It's a 1/4-inch steel encased in concrete in the middle of the bedrock. You can't see the outside of the tank, so how do you really know how well pitted it is? 2 wells are being drilled, but there's nothing that's taken place to try and collect any of the free product. That's the bottom of Tank 5 being inspected. We're working with the Navy on an administrative order on consent. We've given them a draft and said we need to have this order to put things together. It's going back and forth. I wish I could tell you all the details, but I can't. Suffice to say, it's been frustrating. I think that's fair to say. And what ultimately we would like to do is to see all of these tanks updated to modern standards. Double lining, leak detection. It's only a few billion dollars. Come on, you're the Navy. You can handle it. It's going to require action from Congress and funding to do this. But the bottom line is these things are 70 years old. We have history of each one of them leaking. You're over our public trust groundwater. We know you've already contaminated it. It's time to invest. Fix these things up or shut them down. Simple soundbite from me. And I'm just going to go real quick into molasses update because you might be interested. Remember last year we spilled half of an Olympic swimming pool into the harbor and stained all of Honolulu Harbor and killed 40,000 marine organisms. And we did the response, the recovery. The whole thing is in litigation now, trying to settle the claim against Matson. The pipeline has been capped, but it's still full of molasses. Those are the molasses tanks. They actually spilled to land before they spilled into the harbor. So while no molasses is moved in or out of the harbor, it's still in the tank and it's still in the pipeline until the litigation is resolved. And so we hope it won't spill anymore, and at least it's not under pressure. So there we go, pretty picture of why. I have a question. Do I take it now?
Sure. Yeah, there's time for a question.
Time for a question.
So what's the Navy's response to fixing these tanks up or shutting them down?
Okay. There's not just one Navy. There's the Pacific Command, there's the Pearl Harbor, there's the facilities, and there's the logistics agency, right? Defense Logistics Agency that owns the fuel. So from the standpoint of the owner of the fuel who has the liability, the general high in the Defense Logistics Agency will go like, this is crazy. What do we want underground tanks for? They're a problem everywhere. They're 70 years old. We got to get out of them, right? Let's privatize this whole oil system and let Chevron run it or something. From the standpoint of the Navy Admiral, it's like, over my dead body, you taking my tanks away, right? Because show me where else on the planet, when the lights go out and there's no power, I can still fill up three battleships in a day, right? So if somebody's going to guarantee me, and this is like a quote, if somebody can promise me there will never be a war, you can take my tanks. So we're stuck in the middle. And that's why I said, I'm not telling you to shut them down. I'm telling you to fix them up, right? If they're 70 years old. They're quarter-inch steel. They're in the water. They're rusted. You tried to fix it up. It didn't work. What about the other 16, 17 that are still in production?
So basically, the Admiral's not concerned about the environmental impacts.
Oh, well, I wouldn't say that. I think that we have gotten a lot of response at the highest levels of the Navy. Have taken this to our congressional delegation, Pentagon, who knows about it, is talking about it. It's a big question. How much are you going to invest in doing it, and is the technology there available to double-line tanks like this size? Happy to talk more after.
I'm just going to do this while you're finishing your sentences.
Okay. Thanks for the question.
Sorry.
I think we've exhausted my time, but I'm happy to chat with people afterwards.
Thank you.
Good morning. Good morning. All right. And?
Good morning.
Well, I'm sitting in for Commissioner Hartig today. He couldn't make it, but of course he believes strongly in all the good work that the task force does, so he's here in spirit. I'm going to highlight a few things that are happening in the state of Alaska. Obviously, that's what we're doing today at this panel in particular, so I'm just going to go over some of the highlights of what we're experiencing up in the northern state of the U.S. I have no major spills to report, which I'm happy to say. It sounds like that's a trend that we're all sharing. But we did have a few smaller events that I'll highlight just to give you a sense of what we're dealing with. In particular, there's been a rash of truck rollovers. There's been increased fuel shipment going up to the North Slope as there's been a greater interest in developing or redeveloping some of the oil exploration and production work going on up there, and because of that, they're bringing up more refined low sulfur diesel fuel, and those trucks are having problems en route. The problem is that when they roll over on this highway, the pipeline is going along the highway. So when they spill the fuel, it's one spill in particular ended up going right on top of the pipeline, which makes removal quite difficult. It wasn't a lot of fuel, but when you're dealing with that kind of a resource right below the spill, it makes removal quite tricky. So we've had a few incidents doing that. There was two in particular. One was 189 gallons, but because it was right over the pipeline, it made it very difficult to remove that fuel. But the pipeline owner, of course, is very interested in having it removed. And then we had a larger one of 2,561 barrels from Nana Oil Field Services. We had to flush the tundra with 750,000 gallons of water to release the fuel so that we could pick it up with absorbent materials. So that took quite a bit of time, and both of those cleanups are still underway. Another issue that we made significant progress this last year is at the Alyeska Valdez Marine Terminal. They've had secondary containment issues. Their secondary containment includes a liner, dike walls, drainage features, and piping. You can imagine there's a significant snow fall in Valdez, and so their secondary containment system has to address that amount of liquid and drain the snow, but be able to be turned off and closed in the event of a release. So we had issues with the piping. We put them under a notice of violation because the secondary containment system was unable to be completely closed off. They were unable to meet they tried to fix it and were unable to complete that by October 2012, which was the deadline for the NOV. And so we put them under a compliance order by consent, which we just got signed last month. We all agree on what fixes need to happen. It's just been difficult to get ones that work. They agreed to do HDPE piping, and then they had to pull up their catalytically blown asphalt liner to fix the piping, and now they also have to prove that the liner is still functioning with those repairs underneath. And you can't see, I'm going to go to this slide here, you can't see the piping, it's all below ground. So that's why you're not seeing it in that slide. But that's a picture of some of the piping there that's going in. Okay, another big event. So wildlife. We've had a couple events of wildlife becoming oiled. Okay, so this is mainly on an island, well, it's all occurring on St. Lawrence Island, which is in the middle of the Bering Straits between Russia and Alaska. So you actually can see Russia from your house if you live on St. Lawrence Island. And I know that's a really old joke, but I couldn't help myself. The problem is we have not been able to identify a responsible party. So there's been several incidents of discovering oiled wildlife. You can see in the upper right-hand corner all the reports we have received. Now, we haven't been able to confirm all those reports. Often, by the time we do find out about it, the animal is sort of unrecoverable. The two or three incidents where we have been able to recover the animals that have been reported as being oiled. We've gotten them to the lab to be tested. We've been unable to determine the source of the oiling. But this is causing great concern for the St. Lawrence Island communities in particular. They're seeing increased vessel traffic going through the Bering Strait, and this is just to them an example of what the future holds. So it's very frustrating. We've been unable to identify a source or see a slick. The barrel at the bottom, there's some assumptions perhaps it's old buried oil on the island and some of the formerly used military sites, of which we have several in Alaska where we have issues, but that was not confirmed. So at this stage, it's still a mystery, but something we spent quite a bit of time working on. Now I'm going to shift to a few sort of big issues and emerging items that we're tracking because they have a big impact on our future. There's been two risk assessments completed in Alaska that are out for public comment right now. And I see Mike Munger in the room. He's responsible for one. So I'll be sure to mention the Cook Inlet risk assessment, which I'm afraid didn't make it into my presentation because I didn't have the information soon enough. But the Aleutian Island risk assessment is, and that was a big one. So I'm going to spend most of my time talking about that one. That was a significant endeavor undertook using settlement money from the Selandang IU, which was a ship that spilled some oil and also a lot of soybeans. In this slide, you can see how Alaska is divided up by sub-areas. We have 10 sub-areas in the state of Alaska. So this risk assessment is focused on the Aleutian Islands to the west, to the southwest. The preliminary assessment, phase one, was completed a couple years ago, and they have now just completed phase B, which defines what an optimal response system would be in the Aleutian Islands. Again, this is a very remote area without a lot of existing resources. Sorry, I get distracted easy. So this is obviously a picture of one of the reasons why we feel a need to mitigate the risks that we feel are prevalent out there. This is a ship that the Cougar Ace in 2006 that due to a ballast water problem tipped over essentially. Very little oil was spilled, but we were lucky. Some was spilled. So the... sorry, my notes are out of order. I'm trying to find where I'm supposed to be. There are several things that the Aleutian Island Risk Assessment has come up with, and it's out for public comment, as is the Cook Inlet Risk Assessment at the moment. I'm going to give the highlights of what the... Aleutian Island Risk Assessment has decided are the things that should occur to make the Aleutian Islands a safer place for our ability to prevent spills and respond when they occur. The primary thing that they have recommended is that there be a single entity similar to an OSRO that manages all the prevention and response activities. That seems like a no-brainer, but it's important that it be acknowledged. For prevention, we're focused on vessel routing and two-way communications so that we can ensure compliance with routing and ID problems when they occur quickly and communicate with the vessel to find out what's going on. We need an emergency towing vessel, a tug, stationed in Adak, Alaska. This map isn't really that helpful, but there is towing capacity in Dutch Harbor, which is a little further up the chain, closer to the mainland. So the risk assessment feels that one's needed further out to reach vessels that may have problems that aren't near Dutch Harbor. We also need an enhanced salvage capability, which would require a dedicated oil storage barge and a heavy lift helicopter lightering package. Somewhere in the region. We need increased nearshore recovery capability. All the assessment looked at all the different options you have for response in the Aleutian climate. And let's just say you can't do much in open water. The weather just will preclude that in most cases. So if we're going to respond and actually pick up oil, it's going to have to be nearshore. That's just the only way we could actually operate the equipment in a safe way. So that's sort of the focus if we are going to proceed. The risk assessment felt that the funding for all of this could be borne by large vessels that are currently transiting the Aleutian Islands that are already subject to U.S. jurisdiction. Now, that is a small percentage of the vessels that are transiting. The majority are in innocent passage, which is the ones so far that we've had to respond to. They're the vessels that have had the problems. And if you just looked at volume, it makes sense. It's not that they're worse vessels. There's just more of them. So we're not sure how that's all going to play out and how any of these recommendations, frankly, are going to be implemented. The next step is for the sub-area committee, the Aleutian Islands sub-area committee, to take those recommendations and put them forward through a U.S. Coast Guard alternative compliance area. We're still working out how that's all going to happen, but it's going to take a special designation through the U.S. Coast Guard to allow this system to be established, because even it wouldn't be sufficient enough to meet the current federal vessel response plan regulations. It would be better, much better, than what we have now, but it's still not going to be sufficient. So it's going to have to be under an alternative planning criteria that we're able to accomplish this and set up the system. And we are in the throes of that at this very moment. We spent quite a bit of time working on Arctic Council issues since we are an Arctic state. We with interest in production and exploration in the Outer Continental Shelf, where we, as all our residents, are concerned and want to make sure that there's no impacts to our way of life and our environment. There are several standing committees in the Arctic Council that are in operation, and I'm not going to go into those because I don't want to do that. You can always go find out more information about them if you're interested. But we're also working particularly right now on a task force that has been established to develop prevention for vessels transiting the Arctic and oil exploration and production. So some of the measures that the vessel group is focused on is the Polar Code and the changes that the International Maritime Organization. And then on the exploration and production side, we are developing a Arctic Regulators Forum, which is just forming right now. We expect to have our first meeting probably, I think, Copenhagen in March. So lots is happening through the Arctic Council and the IMO Polar Code to try to address the risks that we're seeing in the Arctic and predicting to occur. But when it comes from a risk perspective, the state of Alaska has much more concern about the Aleutians still. Obviously, the Arctic is a future that we foresee the risks increasing, but when you look at vessels transiting, it is the Aleutians that are still where we see the greatest risk to our coastlines. The International Maritime Organization and the Polar Code is something, though, that we care quite a bit about, and there's a lot of movement occurring right now in that area. There's unique risks in the Arctic, so I'll go over briefly, since I have a few minutes, just what changes we're seeing in the Polar Code. I'm not going to talk about all of them, but just give you a sense. The weather conditions obviously are an issue. There's lack of good charting in the Arctic areas. The communication system and navigational aids pose challenges. Remoteness in the area makes rescue and cleanup difficult. And then the cold temperatures, the ambient air temperatures, impact a ship's ability to operate machinery and emergency equipment, including propulsion systems. So with all of those concerns, the draft Polar Code is broken up into two areas. One is ship construction, and they're looking at ways that ships should be designed to deal with those conditions, and then they're also looking at the environment and the ways that that transits can occur and still protect the environment. So ships will have to do routing measures and decide where they're going to go and what things they might encounter in that route, and make decisions to avoid things if they need to. It will require training for ice navigation. It will require certification of vessels, which is a big deal, and an operational manual that will go with the ship to make sure that the crew is aware of the limitations of the vessel. There'll be limitations on discharges, as there already is, but there are no current facilities to take wastes from ships in the Arctic, at least the Alaska side, so how that's going to be rectified is yet to be determined. And finally, I'll end with something we're doing within the department in my division, spill prevention and response. Our funding is declining. Oil production funds our work that comes down the pipeline. We have a 4 cent surcharge per barrel of oil. When we were generating 1 million barrels in oil a day, that was a sustainable arrangement, but we're down to 500,000 barrels a day. So we are only generating about half the revenue that we need to sustain our daily prevention work. This has been coming for quite a while. I mean, this has been a predictable situation, but no one has really stepped forward with a solution. Unfortunately, this year we have no choice. We are out of funds as of this year. We are needing emergency supplemental funding just to balance our budget. So we are using that opportunity to do some introspective work. We are looking at ways we could improve the efficiencies in our services and tighten our belts. There are several cost-cutting things we're doing, which are quite common: travel reductions, not making large purchases. But the other large thing that we're doing is combining two of our programs. We're combining our prevention program with our response program. So we're hoping a benefit of that will be greater synergy between preparedness and response, and that when we respond, we're actually using the good work we've done in planning to build upon our response. So there's been lots of work groups internally and lots of discussions with key stakeholders to get their opinion about how we should best do that. But we're well on our way to reducing our budget to some degree, definitely not enough to fill the gap that's needed, but at least to show that we were serious about trying to be more efficient in our work as our governor and our legislature decide how to fund us. And this last slide just shows the declining revenue. That mountain is what sustained us for all these years, and the mountain is gone. That is this was our historical balance. And we're now at a point where our yearly revenue doesn't support our yearly costs. And that's all I have.
Morning, everybody. Wes Shoemaker from British Columbia. I just want to, before I begin, acknowledge some of my staff: Graham, Kristen, Laurie. You're hiding somewhere out in the back there. So there's the four of us Canucks here. So watch out for us. We're a mighty force for sure. I wanted to, and I'll try and pick up the pace here a little bit. I know it's been a long morning, and I do intend to be somewhat brief, but nonetheless, give you a little bit of a flavor of what's happening in British Columbia these days as it pertains to the operation of our program and, I guess, our whole efforts to both prevent, prepare for, mitigate, respond, and recover from spills of all types. So briefly, we'll walk you through some of the activities that our emergency program has been involved in, some of our work with other agencies and some of the major projects, some notable spill operations over the past year, and then some of the things that we do have on the horizon. So I describe our small program as a lean, green fighting machine comprised of 16 emergency response officers, some 6 program staff. We can, of course, like anybody else, reach into technical experts and other resources, have incident management teams, but even that number for a province of our size, you can wonder how the heck are we ever going to respond effectively to not only a single large spill, but spills of many types, and that is a concern for us. And so as our efforts towards building a more comprehensive program certainly look internally, our work also takes us to really where our whole regime is oriented around is the polluter pay principle. And we are really trying to move more towards an industry-funded, industry-led, an industry-accountable response regime that, of course, as regulators, we have oversight towards, but it's really industry responsibility and accountability. In terms of some of the training over the past year, the usual efforts around making sure that our response officers are current in their certifications. I know this past year, for example, a number of our staff were involved in shoreline cleanup and assessment, incident team management training, and certainly just a lot of our ongoing tabletop exercises or field exercises that we do with some of our partners. And in terms of the historical sort of profile of spills, we continue to be in the order of, on average, about 3,500 spills of all types. Of course, that does include oil spills, but it's about 5% of those, Graham, if I have the numbers correct, that really demand or warrant the field presence or response by some of our staff. So hopefully, like everybody, it's a trend that we want to see go down, but nonetheless, that is what we are dealing with. Over the past couple of years, and I think I alluded to this fact last year, that we have been formally consulting on researching, analyzing, and developing options for a world-leading spill prevention, preparedness, response recovery regime, again, that is world-leading. In Canadian landscape, a little bit different from constitutional authorities. Land-based, for the most part, is within the purview of provinces. As it pertains to in the marine environment, certainly that is the purview of the federal government. And when we talk about energy corridors or pipeline corridors moving in between provinces and either pipeline or the movement of rail, that's within federal jurisdictions. But nonetheless, what we are trying to do is make sure that wherever a spill happens in the marine environment or in the land environment, that we integrate our efforts. Because we all know that spills don't necessarily stay in one space, and as a spill that happens in the marine environment can very well impact in the terrestrial environment. And for that reason, why we believe that we need to develop world-leading regimes in both of those environments. So in terms of our spills developing that world-leading regime, we've released 2 intentions papers, had a number of public consultations, we've had workshops, we've had symposiums, and we are now pulling in all of that information together into developing options for that very robust robust world-leading regime that we intend to bring to our cabinet, at least for policy direction in terms of having the public, earning the public confidence that we can both prevent but recover, respond to and recover from spills of any type. And we think, I may have also talked about a principled approach that our province, our government has taken into the requirements for any heavy oil pipelines. There have been 5 conditions. 2 of them relate to dealing with spills. Condition 2 is world-leading regimes for spills in the marine environment. And condition number 3 deals within the terrestrial environment. So all of the work that I just described around our efforts on the land-based spills intentions paper certainly will contribute to meeting that condition number 3. As we work with other agencies, there's a few things that have developed over the past year that I did want to give credit to or let you know of the work that needs to happen in earning that social license. And the first relates to our efforts to work with First Nations community. In our province, we have some 203 separate First Nations entities all over throughout the province. who have historical, ancestral, constitutional rights and titles to the enjoyment of the lands. And again, I won't get into this as another long story, but some recent Supreme Court decisions that changed the whole landscape for how we engage with First Nations. But nonetheless, as stewards of the land for many, many generations, they have local knowledge, and they have even a greater vested interest in what's happening in their backyard. So to the extent that we're able to engage with First Nations, I think will help us to succeed in, on the one hand, balancing environmental protection with some of the economic development that needs to occur. So some of the things that have happened, therefore, as it pertains to First Nations communities, relate to, for example, the Environmental Stewardship Initiative that was recently announced, where there is a direct role for government, sorry, for First Nations governments and First Nations communities along the midstream to be involved in things such as monitoring for the cumulative effects of pipeline corridors or cumulative effects on important values that we agree upon, being involved in mitigation or habitat conservation projects, being involved in certainly some of the response efforts, and just certainly help us to be involved in some of the resource decisions. When it comes to the federal government, and I'm not ashamed to say it, the pushing that we encouraged them to step up to the plate in many areas, they certainly have done that in a number of areas, and I'll just give you a quick flavor of those, with the theme, though, of more work yet to be done. But over the past couple of years, the federal government started with, when it came to the marine environment, the tanker safety panel. A panel, nonetheless, that traveled the country, met with stakeholders of all types, and developed recommendations for how oil could be moved a lot more safely in the marine environment. And some of the things that resulted from the work of the tanker safety panel included the requirement for double-hull tankers, the increased use in navigational aids, geographic response plans, escort tugs. And to my friends at the U.S. Coast Guard, the requirement that the Canadian Coast Guard finally get on the program and follow the incident command system. And as, I'll speak only to myself, as a career emergency manager, that seemed like a no-brainer, but obviously it took a little bit more convincing, but I'm happy to say that we did get there. Pipeline safety was another area where the federal government has stepped up to the plate and has new requirements related to increased frequency of inspections, of audits, increased their administrative monetary penalties for being out of compliance on a number of elements, stronger blue-to-pay legislation, the requirement for $1 billion of security liability assurance to be in place for any of these projects, and that there be a requirement, a demonstration of company senior leadership commitment to safety and ensuring safety is in place. On the rail side, I'll just quickly talk about some of the federal government efforts to try and improve the regulatory regime to ensure the safe transportation through that mode of transport. Included, as I heard some of the other panel members speak to the need for safer tank car design, for the need to have emergency response and assistance plans in place. And I guess when trains, for example, are carrying hazardous materials, that certainly some of the speed at which they travel is commensurate with the cargo that they are moving. I don't know. I don't recall, Graham, we were having this discussion, whether I alluded to the fact last year that the Brigadier General Zelensky oil spill recovery operation, if you're not familiar with the ship, it was a United States transport vessel that ran aground during a storm and sank in Grenville Channel while en route to Alaska from Seattle in 1946, and it now rests under 90 feet of water, roughly 100 kilometers south of Prince Rupert in northern British Columbia. And the vessel itself has been the numerous source of small spills for years and years and years until recently, where parties came together with the viewer recovering the Bunker Sea oil that was on this ship, and it was a six-week operation with a budget of $50 million that recovered 43.9 tons of Bunker Sea fuel, but almost, going to do my quick math, 10 times that, almost. Anyways, lots of oily waste or water recovery. But for us, it was really the first opportunity in an integrated fashion where we ran operations with Coast Guard or other partners where we came at the task of recovering submerged oil and knew a lot of lessons learned about how we needed to work together and how operations of this type were very complex but nonetheless could be successfully accomplished. So a good news story on that front, but an important learning lesson for all of us. Another notable spill event, unfortunately, and we aren't talking oil spills in this case, but nonetheless, Gary, happened. Good luck on my part. I was in Honolulu at the time that a tailings pond facility in a open pit copper gold mine breached, releasing 17 million cubic meters of effluent and 7 million cubic meters of a sediment down into both Polly Lake, into Hazeltine Creek, and into Quinnell Lake, impacting on community water supply. And nonetheless, presenting a huge challenge for us across all of government, but in our spills program to not only deal with a spill of that type in that area, but to try and regain and re-earn public confidence that resource development can happen very safely. It's something, an event that we still deal with daily, have far-reaching implications for our community, but I guess this is the lessons to be learned of the consequences that result from not doing our utmost best to try and prevent spills or releases of any type in any portion, but the consequences are big. So, just in the final slide that I wanted to mention to you, and maybe on the last topic, I'll get an opportunity later on to invite you to the big event happening next year in British Columbia. But some of the things that are on our horizon relate to that ongoing resource development activity. A couple of key energy corridors moving across the country that are going to be impacting directly in very sensitive areas of British Columbia. Trans Mountain Kinder Morgan pipeline and the Northern Gateway pipeline. And suffice to say is a lot of work needs to be done to ensure that there's public confidence that the movement of oil can occur safely. And I think the lesson also to be learned is notwithstanding you can have the best technical solution, if you can't convince and involve the public that this can be done safely, it becomes even a more difficult row to hoe to see these projects approved. And therein lies the challenge then, as some of these projects are moving through the regulatory process, to make sure that we are satisfied, certainly as regulators, but the public is convinced that spills not only can be prevented, but in the rare circumstance that they might occur, that they can be minimized and we can effectively and quickly recover from those operations. So that's it. Thanks again for the chance to update you on what's going on in British Columbia. And again, we'll talk later about inviting you next year to our province. Thank you.
Back. One of the things I forgot to mention in my opening remarks is that we as task force members get to stand up here and talk about everything that we do. For the task force, we have a coordinating committee that consists of a member from each of the states and in British Columbia. And by way of surrogate representing everyone, I want to call out Mike Zolich, who is Oregon's task force member. You can see in the annual report who all those task members are, or those coordinating committee members are. And they really do a lot of work in working with Sarah and Hillary, really making this organization hum. So I really want to make sure we recognize those folks. So, and they're, I think they're all here. So let's give them a hand. Yep. One thing that was unique that I was listening to when all my task force friends up here were talking was just, you know, we love to talk about the spills that we have, and it's very informative and interesting to hear about. Unfortunately, they're not so fun when they're going on or you hear about them, and our job certainly is to work to prevent that from happening. And all of us, I think, would dearly love not to have to spend our many days and months working on some of the things that we have to when a spill occurs. So it's really important that we do work hard to do what we can to prevent those from happening. In Oregon, as pointed out in the slide here, we get a lot of notices of spills every year. For instance, in this case, we had 1,325 notices of potential spills between July 13th and June 2014. We responded to about 850 of those. That's a lot. And what I wanted to mention here is the importance of having some readiness. And we in Oregon, as other states, have people on call 24 hours a day. And unfortunately, most of those calls don't come in between 8 and 5. Although I'll say at a conference like this, if 3/4 of the people pick up their iPhone at one time and start looking at it, it's one of those uh-oh, because everybody's got to do something because we're all ready for that. But those folks that are on call 24 hours a day really have to be on their game when that call comes in at 2 in the morning. And if you want to know what it's like in Oregon, you can talk to Kimberly Van Patten, who works hard on that aspect of it here, and she could tell you. Also, an important element of responding to a spill is informing the public what's going on and working with our media partners to do so. And if you want to find out what that's like in Oregon, you can talk to Marcia Danup, who's our public affairs officer for the northwest part of the state, and how much we have to use our media partners to inform the public, who is very interested and needs to know what goes on when a spill occurs. Also, in some of those cases, as has been pointed out here, we have to respond. We have to be out there, and we have folks that are in the ready to go. And it's always not the most pleasant thing to do. A couple of examples that we have just in the past year, where we had a hazardous material spill on a major interstate in eastern Oregon that required a response and cleanup that included not only a serious health risk, but response with SCBA, major traffic to deal with out in eastern Oregon. It was not in the most pleasant time of the year, snow, wind, blowing, sort of thing. Or in the past year, a fuel tanker spills, goes down a ravine, it quickly soaks into the ground, and in order to protect the folks that have lived in their home for decades, their family home for decades, the only way to do that is to tell them, we have to demolish your home. And if you want to know what that's like, talk to Mike Rentz, who's here in the audience, and see what that was like dealing with that. But those are just examples of what we have to do when we respond to spills. And I really want to give a shout out to those folks that are really behind the scenes and sometimes in front of the scene when these things happen. So let's give them all a hand, really. Well, I mix those up. We'll see how that goes. The other thing we don't talk about a lot is near misses. We do preparedness and we do response, but there's a lot of things that happen that almost can turn into a disaster. And being on the ready for that is really important. For instance, in just recently, we had a vessel that was carrying 75,000 gallons of diesel and 23,000 metric tons of copper concentrate that was ran aground in the mouth of the Columbia area. And fortunately, that vessel was able to be refloated. But there was a precarious situation. If that vessel got grounded and ruptured, it would have created a serious problem in the mouth of the Columbia, not only from environmental impact, but responding in an area that's very tidal, very difficult, is really a challenge. And also, you know, train derailments that happen, like the example I put up here, happen, and there's some fortunate examples where either they're not carrying product or don't get away. But there's a lot of near misses that don't necessarily get talked about a lot, but it's really telling in terms of our need to be ready to respond and being helpful when those near misses occur. I'm going to change it up a little bit and not talk a lot about those spills or spills that we had. I'm going to talk more about emerging issues, and one particular emerging issue for the spill preparedness, mostly, and response, hopefully not, is the very much increase in transport of energy commodities that are happening everywhere in all of our states. And with a lot of export facilities, you know, we have increased tank vessels transporting crude. We have coal being railed in and potentially being barged down rivers and across oceans. And we have proposed liquefied natural gas facilities that are things to think about. And it's really changed the game in the way of how we have to think about being prepared for things that might happen related to this kind of increased energy commodity movement, and also public awareness. And that's a good thing. But it really has created an interesting and new dynamic of how the public wants to know about all this information. And, you know, like I said, that's a good thing, but it does put pressure on agencies and provinces in terms of being able to inform the public of how we are getting ourselves ready and working with others to get us ready with this changing energy dynamic that we have. So I'm going to focus a little bit on this, and you'll hear a lot more about rail traffic of oil later on in the program, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but speak from specifically from Oregon. We're going to talk a lot about increase in Bakken crude oil being shipped in or being railed in and transferring to facilities and moved up to refineries. And so in Oregon, we have two transloading facilities already in Oregon. One is in the Clatskanie Columbia River area, and another one is Portland Willamette River. And both these facilities are required to have oil spill contingency plans, which they do have, and we put together one of them most recently, the Clatskanie one, and so that's fortunate that we're working on that. Certainly, and I'll talk later about this, the increase and need to think about that increased rail traffic and how we might be ready to prepare and respond to that. And I think some of us alluded to that earlier. Also related to that, we have the Columbia Pacific Biorefinery, which is the transloading facility out in down the Columbia River. And just to give you an idea of the public interest in this kind of facility, which I said is great, is that we also do more than just prepare an oil spill contingency plan for these facilities. We have to issue permits that to them that will comply with all the environmental regulations. Well, we hold public hearings for our permits and get that word out, and we could have not only a massive amount of comments, which again is good, but also have public hearings that will draw 1,000 people that want to know about what this facility's going to be like. And we, as public entities and state agencies, our duty is to not only take those comments in, it's to listen to them and make changes to whatever permit might be worked on. But if in fact those comments lead to a necessary change based on our environmental laws and rules. So there's a lot of interest in public awareness about this, and then relative to oil spill contingency plans, we got about 100 comments on that. We typically don't get that amount of comments on a proposed oil spill contingency plan. So again, there's a lot of interest and concern, and it's all good, and it takes time and effort, and as pointed out here, it extends the process by months, sometimes longer, again, which is all good, but it's a reality that we have to deal with. We have a couple of liquefied natural gas proposals in Oregon that we're working on. One is down Coos Bay. It's called Jordan Cove. This isn't the facility up there, as pointed out. It's just a drawing of it. And also up in Warrenton, which is on the mouth of the Columbia River, basically Oregon LNG, which is proposed there. Again, it's just reflective of energy transport or energy change that encompasses all forms of energy. And again, things come up as it relates to LNG in particular. And there was a project that was proposed earlier that one of the big concern is increase ship traffic in the Columbia with these massive ships, and what does that mean to other traffic on the Columbia, or concern about explosion from LNG and all the sorts of things that folks are really concerned about, and we have to be prepared to respond to. Coal export is another thing that's really on the radar screen for many of us, certainly in Oregon. For us in Oregon, there's a proposal for a coal export facility at the Port of Morrow near Boardman, Oregon, which is in basically northern central Oregon, and trains delivering coal from from Wyoming would be railroaded down the Columbia Corridor, mostly on the Washington side, I believe, and then transloaded to barges and then shipped out the Columbia River and then transloaded to ships, and off it goes. That's the proposal. So increased traffic, increased concern for spills that people are asking questions about. That permit is, that facility is a bit in... still in debate. Permits haven't been issued. One of the permits has been recently denied, so there's still a lot of discussion about whether that's going to happen or not. Other types of energy I'll just bring up, both wave and wind are being looked at and piloted in off the Oregon coast, and what we think about that in terms of concern for preparedness and response is these big units out in the coast, what kind of hazard are they for traffic that is going up and down the coast that's delivering potentially oil or hazardous material. So there's a concern we have to think about for that. And as far as future challenges go, I always like to think about climate change, which is we're feeling that. A couple places we feel that is certainly different kinds of water delivery, which might change the level of water in, say, the Columbia that has that has barge traffic on it. Does that affect things that are moving up and down the river, or the severity of storms that might occur based on climate change, which we're feeling, and I know all of us are feeling in some way? What does that do, or what effect does that have, and what kind of response preparedness does that require? And finally, I was just going to end with real quickly with the our review of the rail safety process that's going on, and this is where my notes might be mixed up, so I'll apologize for just 1 second or longer. So Oregon's response, which can be found at that website real quickly, we discussed some key issues and in some of the roles of federal and state agencies and some of the findings, really highlighting some of the key points for Oregon. Rail notification to emergency responders on oil and hazardous transport was necessary, and that should include access to train manifests in response to derailments if they would occur. A recommendation that adequate rail inspectors in Oregon to ensure track maintenance and train safety requirements, updating regulations to address changes in transportation risks and rail safety, and state review of rail oil spill contingency plans, which should identify equipment caches, response time objectives, and geographic response plan development for inland rail corridors. I won't talk about this. Well, just real quickly, at Oregon DEQ, we're really trying to look at our business model in a way that focuses on outcomes, delivering on the outcomes that we're trying to achieve, and not so locked down on our processes, and really a focus on that. And we've been engaged in that for about 2 or 3 years now, and really think of how we operate as a public and environmental agency in a way that really achieves the outcomes that we're trying to get to. Certainly when it comes to preparedness and oil oil and hazardous material preparedness, spill preparedness and response, we want to make sure that we're not doing unnecessary steps, if you will, to get to the outcome of make sure we're prepared for spills and make sure we can respond in a very timely and effective manner. So with that, I am done, and the time is 5 to 10.
Well done.
Thank you. it is break time right now, and what I'd like to do is we're going to start promptly at 10:15, so I'd like the panelists on the next panel to be here and up on the stage maybe a minute or two before 10:15. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Nice job, people.
Spills and more spills.
You guys are awesome.
Oh my goodness, is anybody in here?
Okay. We need to switch out the cards for the panelists up here. Are you recording this whole thing?